You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones. And in this episode, I sit down with the shockingly funny Sarah Silverman. As a third grader, Sarah Silverman had already narrowed her future career to three options: comedian, actress, or masseuse. She landed pretty quickly on comedian and never looked back, dropping out of college with the support of her father, who financed her New York City apartment and three-year curriculum of comedy club work. Success came rapidly and almost unbelievably when she was hired as a Saturday Night Live writer at just 22 years old, sans audition. She was fired almost as rapidly, without any of her work ever appearing on the show. Former SNL writer Bob Odenkirk said, "I could see how it wouldn't work, because she's got her own voice. She's very much Sarah Silverman all the time. She doesn't disappear into the character. She makes the character her." Despite some noted TV and film appearances, Silverman never looked at stand-up as a stepping stone to an acting career. She is a stand-up comedian the way, quote, some people are gay. She compulsively reveals her painful past, which included depression and bedwetting into her teens. Her combination of honesty and true comedic skill results not in a series of jokes, but a series of insights that universally connect, all the more stealthily for being cloaked in humor. Sarah talks to Off Camera about her breakout special, Jesus is Magic, and about the decision to film the more recent We Are Miracles in front of a vast audience of 39, and about living the low overhead dream. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Sarah Silverman.
Sam Jones.
Thank you for coming and doing this. You know, I've been a fan of yours for a long, long time, and, you know, a lot of these, I end up photographing somebody and we meet and then I ask them to come, but you just came down here like without even knowing me. So I really appreciate that. I think that you are like a lot of artists. You just are who you are. You know what I mean? And I think no matter what it is you do, the life force or the you comes out of you and you can't be anyone different. Like Woody Allen, like Richard Pryor, like Carol Burnett. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I am amazing.
Yeah, you are amazing. Let me ask you this. What is it, like, you've done this a long time, obviously. What is it that you still really love about what you do?
I like the diversity of it. I like being able to, I like all the new mediums. I like being able to make a video on my couch about something that's important to me or something just aggressively stupid. You know, I love television and watching it, you know, and I love working in that and getting to do little parts in movies or, you know, but then I just kind of identify as a stand-up because that's who I am, you know, and, you know, I mean, I just was in the bathroom, like, giggling. I was like, if somebody is hearing me right now, I'm, like, sitting by myself laughing. But if I, you know, thinking of funny things and writing it down and giving it a try and stuff.
Well, that's the thing. When I look at you, I see someone who never, like a lot of comedians, you feel like they see their stand-up thing as maybe a stepping stone to something else, like to be in films or get a pilot or whatever. With you, it just seems like that is who you are. And it wasn't just part of some bigger plan to be famous or in movies or something. You kind of, that's who you are, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think of being a stand-up is like, or being a comic is like being gay. You know, it's just, you're born that way and it's just who you are. It's not necessarily your job or your thing. It's just like who you are.
Right. When did you kind of realize that?
When I was very young. I mean, because comedy was always like my power and it kind of was my protection. And this isn't a unique story at all. It's probably every comedian's story in broad strokes, you know?
Sure.
And my survival skill, you know? And like so many of the things you learned to do to survive childhood, you know, in a perfect world, you unlearn in your adulthood, you know, if you,
sure,
you are searching enough to kind of figure out. And but it's the one thing you don't have to kind of unlearn, but maybe you don't use it as a way to survive, you know. Hopefully by this time you use it to thrive, you know.
Right, you know, this. Right. And was there a point when you said, oh, I can actually, like, do this for a living? Like, this can be my, like, was there something that dawned on you where you said, oh, this is legitimate, it isn't just, you know, protection or something that works socially, but it actually could be something I could do my whole life?
Yeah, well, I knew that I was funny, and because it's how I got through the day growing up in New Hampshire. And I saw on TV, on The Tonight Show and stuff, that there were comedians. So, you know, like, my mom showed me a thing I filled out in third grade. It said, when I grow up, I want to be. And then I wrote, a comedian, an actress, or a masseuse.
Really?
But I know why I said masseuse is because I'm the youngest, and they'd get me to rub their shoulders, my sisters and my parents, and then to keep me going, they'd go, you're so good at this, you know? And I'd be like, oh, you know? So I really felt like I was great at it, and I think I am good at it. But...
No, but that's amazing in third grade that... Because, I don't know, when I was young, I didn't really see the arts and entertainment as, like, a career. I just saw it as something you did because you loved. But, you know, to be in third grade and go, oh, yeah, I want to be that when I grow up.
I feel so lucky because, you know, as you grow up, you see so many friends and, you know, people that you love that don't know what they're searching. They don't know what their passion is. And not to feel sorry for them, that's just a different thing, but I feel so lucky to always have known, you know, like, what I wanted and who I was, you know, in my core. And there was just never a backup plan or anything. It was just, it just was.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know.
Well, it's, you know.
But you're so lucky when you know what you want.
Yeah.
You know, that's such a gift, I know. I went to NYU for 1 year, and I was a drama major, but I was passing out flyers it was in New York, a comedy club called the Boston Comedy Club on 3rd Street. And I was always such a good student, you know, I think because I wanted my teachers to like me, and I just always was. And it was the first time that I was, like, falling asleep in class and stuff because I was working till 2 a.m. and then getting up real early for class. But the classes, I mean, it's a great school and stuff, but I had a little bit of a scholarship, but it's so expensive to be going to, like, voice class and movement class. And, you know, so I told my dad I wanted to switch to arts and sciences and, like, study... have academic classes. I could take acting class outside at an acting class. I just felt like I was wasting. And so I switched to arts and sciences. But before I started, my dad called me and said, if you drop out of college, I'll pay for your next 3 years' rent as if it were your sophomore, junior, senior year. And you keep doing comedy and... because I knew I didn't need a diploma. I just wanted to learn stuff, you know? So it was a great deal. It saved him so much money. And, you know, my rent was $350 a month. And then, you know, by the time I would have graduated, I got a job writing at Saturday Night Live.
I find that amazing that your dad would say, go ahead and drop out of college. Like you think about that, that's kind of insane. But it must have told you, my dad believes in me, like, wholeheartedly. Like, that's a huge thing, you know? Like, I would have a hard time telling my kid to drop out of college just because you'd get second-guessed by everyone you told that story to.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I guess He could have made it about ego and said, well, if she doesn't do well and I told her to do that, it will look bad about me. But he didn't, you know, I don't think he really thought about it like that, you know. And it, looking back on it, not to say like, oh, I didn't really think what ifs. I just like, you know how like nobody could break the 4-minute mile in running, and then it just took that one person who didn't know better, didn't know that he couldn't or she could, I don't know who it was.
Right.
And then, so they did, and then everybody could. But it's just, I feel like, listen, I'm very aware of my limits in lots of ways, but in that particular case, I feel like it just didn't even, I didn't know to think about what if I fail.
Right. So in that time that you would have gone to college, you worked, you did stand up, and then you got a Saturday Night Live audition, right? Now you're a writer, do you have to audition?
I never auditioned for Saturday Night Live. I was doing stand up, and that's all I was doing. I was just doing stand up, and okay. I had just gotten 2 stand-up shows, Evening at the Improv and a show called Comic Strip Live. And they saw me on one of those, and they came to see me live, and then I had a meeting with Lorne Michaels and the head writer, Jim Downey. And then they just offered me a writing job that I was also a feature player.
Do you remember a particular, like, anchor of your act back then, a joke that was, like, when you were that young?
I felt I gave a guy a fake number, but I felt so bad, so I moved there. I just remembered that. That was the joke I had.
That's funny. I don't want to go into your whole time at Saturday Night Live because that's well documented, but I did hear that you lasted 1 year and you've been very candid about it not being the greatest year, and that's sort of what I took away from your autobiography.
No, I mean, it was a great boot camp. I mean, it's really long hours, and it's, you know, kind of the illusions that you think, like, I can create things and they go on the show. And I mean, that probably is the case for more talented members of the the writing and acting staff there. But, you know, I look back at it as such a great experience, and I can't believe that Lorne Michaels saw something in me, because, you know, I when I was writing my book, I remember thinking, you know, I'm like Larry David because I wrote all these sketches and none of them got on. And then I went back and I read them, and they're terrible. They're terrible.
So you feel like, was it just too young? Was it like...
Yeah, I was 21, 22... Turned 22, and, you know, some people are at their peak then. I mean, you know, but I'm sure I had something, but I was not anywhere near the best of my abilities, I think, at
right.
that time. You know, I was still...
Yeah, you're so young. I mean, did you remember feeling pressure, like, this has to work, or, again, was it like...
No, it did not... It did not occur to me ever once that I would, that would be the only year I was there. I mean, it didn't occur to me that I would not be asked back or be fired in a million years. It didn't even cross my mind.
Really?
I was so surprised. Yeah.
And how were you informed?
I think because I just didn't know better. It just didn't even, I was writing sketches for the next season over the summer. I was all excited, you know, and... When I got it called that I wasn't asked back, I was like, what? Like, it didn't even occur to me that was an option.
Now, who calls at that point? Like, do they bring you in? How did you find out?
No, my agent and manager at the time called me and told me, and I was like, I thought they were kidding. I mean, just, I don't know why. Maybe that's good that I just didn't even cross my mind, you know, or maybe it's bad. Maybe I would have worked harder and done better. I don't know, but... The figure is all the universe's plan or whatever.
Now, what do you think, so after that, and obviously soon after that, you came out to L.A., right?
Yeah, I mean, well, for a couple of years, I didn't know if I was in show business anymore, you know? I mean, I just was, like, floating around New York doing stand-up, you know? And yeah, then I moved out to Los Angeles in 95 and got fired. I got cast in a pilot, in a sitcom that was going two series, and got fired from that the day before we shot the pilot.
Really?
So first of all, I looked like I was 13, and I was cast as, like, a wife and an architect and a mother in New York City. Like, I was so miscast. But I, you know, I didn't know, and so that really, that was when I started anticipating failure.
Really? You know? So a couple of these, and it was like...
I got fired a couple times in a row from big jobs, and I thought, that's when I would, if I got hired for anything, this is before cell phones, so I would, like, wait till the last minute to make sure, like, my manager didn't need to call to tell me I was fired, get to the set and, like, make sure my name was still on the call sheet, you know, just, I went from being so arrogant to so gun-shy.
Did you grow up a little bit after those experiences, or did you vow to, like, oh, I'm gonna show them, or...
No, I think I got a little gun-shy in terms of the things that I couldn't control, and I think I got I buckled down a lot more in stand-up, and it was around then that I started going on Conan, and I became a regular on Conan, where he would let me sit on panel and basically do stand-up conversationally on panel.
What does on panel mean?
On panel means instead of doing a stand-up set, I'm like a guest sitting on the couch, and he's interviewing me, and he's setting me up for jokes that I had written.
I see.
And I loved that, and I loved that format, and he kept having me back. And that was the first time that, like, people in New York would, like, recognize me on the street, like, oh, I love you on Conan, you know? And I loved being able to do stand-up in a more conversational format, because I would write just such jokey jokes, and then to figure out a way to make that, you know, not seem terribly planned, like, you have a monkey, tell me about that, you know,
exactly.
Where it's just such a setup.
Right.
And then I started compiling that material and really, like, working backwards, where I would try things on Conan, and then it would make it into my act.
Oh, that's funny.
You know, and I tend to do that with talk shows, and it's probably not the way you should do it. And people think about burning material and stuff, and, you know, to a degree I do too. But I tend to try things on talk shows and then hone them in my act, you know.
Interesting.
So I started putting together, like, a one-woman show, which was basically just my stand-up, kind of putting it together, and it didn't have to be, like, topics. One thing I learned that felt like a really good lesson was, instead of going, like, I'm going to do all the stuff about airports, and then I'll do all the stuff I have about this topic, I realized that that's not how we talk. And it probably was helpful doing Conan and realizing how, in a natural conversation, the brain goes from one thing to another to another. I mean, I remember one time we were all home in New Hampshire, and must have been Thanksgiving. And there was a commercial for Mrs. Smith's pumpkin pie, and it says, first, Mrs. Smith's, like, pumpkin pie filling.
Right.
And look at this, comes out just like the can. This comes out all, like, you know, pumpkin-y and mushy. And we look, and our mom is crying. And I'm like, Mom, why are you crying? And she goes, well, the pumpkin pie filling looked like baby diarrhea. And then I was thinking about you girls. And then I was just thinking, like, you're never going to be young anymore. And, you know, and it's so funny how the brain goes. And it isn't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily make sense on the surface. And it isn't necessarily linear. But by where like a your natural thought pattern might go, even if it seems very erratic.
Right.
It will make sense still. And so figuring out how to put that together and realizing that, and then I just did a bunch of live shows and a bunch of runs of it. I called it Jesus' Magic because it was the title of one of the, I mean, the a punchline to one of my jokes in it. And just this history, I guess. I don't know what my point was.
Anyway, okay, so you were going back to New York to do Conan. You were living out here at that point. And did you have people that you looked up to?
Yeah. You know, I was surrounded by great comics that I looked up to, Louis C.K. and this comedian Mark Cohen and Liz Winstead and a lot of people. I was at the time I was dating a Second City guy named Tom Giannis who directed.
Okay.
And he really encouraged me to put my stand-up together, not just like a headlining set, but like a cohesive show, you know.
Right, right.
And I'm surrounded by great people and comics I look up to, and
I guess I just have this picture in my mind, and maybe it's totally, you know, romanticized, but I feel like you come out here, you're young, you had a few bad experiences, and then, like, you know, just sort of invented this routine that was really I don't want to say routine, but invented this this act, this persona, you know, that was you, and it was really groundbreaking. And you know what I mean?
I would say a huge part in both shows has been therapy, going to therapy and having a therapist. I had a therapist at that time who I feel like brought the best out in me and made me kind of, I don't know. It's funny when I had this therapist and I was sure she was my best friend.
Right.
Because I was so excited that I had a therapist that I really, like, really loved and really. And then, you know, a couple years into it, I said, do you have any kids? And she's like, yes, I have 5. And I'm like, I guess we're not best friends. It's a little one-sided.
Yeah.
It's all me. That's why it feels so good. I mean, that's why men have affairs with their secretaries. You know, there's like, oh, this person anticipates my every need. Yeah, that's their job.
Exactly.
You know, this woman is, I pay to mirror me. Like, we're such good friends.
When I first saw your whole act, I thought, okay, here's somebody who is both, you know, willing to push the most perverse buttons in people and, like, get this insane, you wanted a reaction, but not just for the reaction. Like, it looked like you wanted a connection through the reaction. And I wondered if that was a conscious decision for you at some point, like, I am going to tackle radioactive material that other people won't touch. Like, was that a decision, or was that just who you are?
No, it was never a conscious decision. I grew up in a household where there were not the same taboos as in the rest of the world, I realized, you know? I mean, my parents were just, there wasn't anything they kept us from or shrouded us from or, you know, for good or for bad. I mean, they're just, everything was kind of open book style.
Right.
And that's just how I was raised, you know? So I can't really take credit for, I never consciously went like, I'm going to bust taboos. What are the taboos? You know, it's just the stuff that I'm obsessed with, that I think about, that takes up the space in my thoughts.
Right, right. I guess
you know, but because Jesus is Magic was like a show that was, there was a lot of race, you know, all the stuff that I thought about a lot, you know, and it was very like I I said the opposite of what I meant, kind of that take of playing a character, this very ignorant yet very arrogant character version of myself that says the opposite of the things I feel, but with the hopes that, not to use a math term, but the absolute power of that transcends, you know, that I don't think there's anyone that goes, wow, she's racist, or, well, yeah, there were some people, but but they were you know, minorities, so but the hope is, and I don't have control over how people infer things with their various life experience being, you know, the background of how they're seeing things, and I can't control that.
Right, but I mean, you have to know. I would think you have to know as you're writing your act, and you know, you write in a piece about, I'm going to be the first comic to shit on Martin Luther King. Like,
well,
you have to know that that's going to, like, you think, like, okay, I'm going to go there, and I'm just going to, or is that just sort of this perverse thing that you like to do, where you like to poke
the audience? It's perverse. It is perverse. I mean, to me, shitting on Martin Luther King, it wasn't like, it was so absurd.
Of course.
And so completely, there was nothing political in it even. It was,
of course.
It was pure silliness, aggressive stupidity. And I remember the one time that got booed, I did some MTV event. I had all these, like, young, you know, teenagers in the audience. And I would have been one of the people booing, too, at that age because I was so earnest. And,
sure.
You know, I remember when I started stand-up, my friend Mark Cohen would put a nickel on his forehead and say Jewish Ash Wednesday, and it would make me cry because it was so awful to me. And it's so funny because I'm still that same person, but the tools that I use to communicate, I understand irony and you know what I mean. I it's funny how I kind of became what I most feared, you know. We probably all do that in a way, you know, where it's like a race became something that I fully went for, you know, when he said Jewish, it wasn't because it was a Jewish thing. It was like anything racial or anything like that would, I was very politically correct. But what I realize is it's all the same as long as the intention is, and there is a line where, there is a line because I, you know, after Jesus' Magic, I got a bad review from A.O. Scott that was right on. Like,
oh,
I agreed
really?
With everything he said, and that notion of, well, I can say the N-word because I'm liberal, and of course I don't mean it, and we can say it because we know that we don't mean it. And there's something gross about that, and I enlisted that kind of I think I depended on that kind of notion in Jesus' Magic, and I still like a lot of it, and I also think it's good to look back on things and go, ugh. But it was definitely a different time as well. I mean, where we're in a much more sensitive time right now. You know, I use this same analogy. I've tried it and tried it, and nobody will buy it. And to me, I get it, and I'm going to try to say it, and you can cut it out. But I feel like over time, roles just reverse, and everything kind of stays the same, but we change. You know, if you just look at conservatives and liberals and conservatives in a very generalistic way, you would say, well, the liberals are Meathead, and the conservatives are Archie Bunker. That's how it used to be.
Exactly.
Of that time.
Absolutely.
And then it became where the liberals were un-PC and the conservatives were very politically correct, but it wasn't from the same kind of moral compass as the original. It was more like because of advertisers and people who write letters and things that affect their purses that made them much more sensitive to political correctness, not the spirit of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see that.
So it's like a reversal in roles, but mutated.
Was there ever a moment where someone that you love, someone in your family, like, had any issues with any of your
No. Thanks. I mean, my mom a couple of times, just from things that are more explicit and graphic, she'll say, she's like, I have a very visual mind. You know, I beg you. I had a joke that I actually tried recently again, which is so, like, when I first started stand-up, that I dropped because she asked me to. And it's because she said she has a very visual mind. And it's so innocuous. It's just about
the jelly
how,
one?
Huh?
Is it the jelly?
No.
Oh, I love
it's,
that one.
It's, you've never seen it because I dropped it before I ever, you know. But it was about how dentists, it was an impression of a blowing a dentist and him going like, oh, are you in school? And you know. It's such a jokey, silly, nothing, you know, whatever. I dropped it. But it's funny that those are the things. It's nothing. It's just like, I don't know, she has a very visual mind. But I also just kind of, I think they have accepted now that it's just, I do what I do. And, you know, my dad, I don't feel like he hears anything I'm saying. He's just so proud. He sits in the audience and he's just looking at other people and he can't believe they're all watching me and laughing. But I don't think he could tell you a single joke of mine. You know?
Really? He's just, you're he's up just there and like, that's all that matters.
Yeah. Can't believe it.
No, it's clear that, you know, you can't be that comfortable in your own skin and with everything that you do without having supportive parents. And you know what I mean? I think that's a big deal. And I think you can't, I don't know.
I think it goes both ways. I mean, there are a lot of comedians that had parents that did not support them at all, and that probably was informed.
Sure.
Them being comedians in a different way.
Being a comedian that draws from her own life and sort of your very first person. You're not the person sitting there going, I know a guy who this and that. It's all about you. And especially maybe even earlier stuff, but decisions to share large parts of your life and be very autobiographical, right? Do you think that's a need that you have as a comedian?
Yeah. Yeah.
You do?
Because it's funny, I have friends that are very the opposite. They don't share any part of themselves. I mean, if you look at Jerry Seinfeld, he shares no part of himself, really, in stand-up, and he's brilliant. And what he does share is always pretty universal. You know, it's not I'm a weirdo stuff. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so but for me, I do have a need that is probably not healthy to kind of tell everyone everything.
Well,
you know, Mark Twain said if you're always telling the truth, you don't have to, you don't ever have to worry about. I don't know. This is a shitty paraphrasing of a really good quote, but it's something.
No, but that's great. Google. It's like if you're always honest, then you never have to worry.
You have
about,
nothing to hide. You have nothing to. So I do like that. I feel like full disclosure at all times.
I don't feel like any true artist is just up there servicing their art. I think they're trying to make connections and you know, be them, like, show themselves in a way. So I wonder if that's, like, your way of wanting to connect or wanting to find out that we're all
definitely
this way.
I mean, growing up, I had secrets because I was a bedwetter, and it was, I thought, would be my biggest, most shame-filled secret of my life. I never thought I would tell anyone that I was a bedwetter. It was so embarrassing. And, of course, I grew up and I became an adult, and I can laugh about it and I can say. But I do remember a moment of I had a little TV in my room and I was watching Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, and he had on a woman who was starring in a miniseries called V. And I think they remade it not long ago. But anyway, she was this beautiful actress, and she said she was a bedwetter when she was growing up. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It changed.
How old were you?
I was probably 13.
So you were still, like, on the verge.
I was still a bedwetter, full on, at 13. And, yeah, this was humiliating. I wasn't a toddler. I was, you know, I mean. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe the notion that there could be a day that I would ever tell anyone, let alone be completely open about it. And it unlocked something in me, you know. It gave me comfort. And so it does make me thrilled to be able to say things like that and know that there's someone out there that's like, really? You know, like, what? You know, or, you know, and they're... I don't have a lot of shame. You know what I mean?
It's really good.
It's a very freeing feeling. You know, and what you were saying about second-guessing material, you know, or, like, thinking about, oh, that's taboo, and this might happen as a result of that. It was a gift that I didn't have that. I rarely think about it. But when I did, it was very stunting because after I did my first special, Jesus is Magic, I became well-known and well-known for doing kind of shock humor, being outrageous or saying things that will surprise people. And so when I continued to write past that, I was stunted because I wanted to give the audience what they expected, and what they expected was to be surprised. And it became this, I felt paralyzed, and it wasn't until I realized that comedy dies in the second guessing and that I have to just write what I think is funny and not worry about shocking anyone or surprising anyone or disappointing people who want to see what is familiar now to them from me. All that stuff is death. So when I threw all that away and I just started over, and then what ended up to be We Are Miracles is very different stylistically, but it reflects who I am now, and there's still some of the same elements because it's still me. But I think I more in this one say more how I feel. I didn't know how to make sincere notions funny at all. You know,
it's funny because that's the thing I noticed between Jesus is Magic and We Are Miracles is Jesus is Magic has a lot of persona that you talk about of the ignoramus who's arrogant, the arrogant ignoramus, yeah. Exactly.
I love that.
And the jokes were very, you know, there was a lot of jokes, but in We Are Miracles, there's a lot more storytelling kind of wrapped up in social commentary in a way, you know, like.
Yeah, and I could never plan that, but it just,
right.
I think.
Well, it seems like, you're on this path where eventually you, just your absolute truest, most authentic self, is going to meet the, you know, super experienced joke writer and everything, and they're going to collide, and it will be a complete, like, it'll be a show of total truth. Like, it seems like you're on this path where you could almost sit down and talk about anything, and because you know yourself so well and because you're just funny, like, the truth is weaved into that. I see that progression in your act, and again, I wonder if that's something that just comes with experience, or if it's something you think about. You say, "Gosh, I want to be when I'm on stage. I want to find a way to be more me." Or are you trying to hide yourself?
That's always the quest. And I mean, I don't have like a show face, you know. I mean, you know, if I may have whatever material I'm doing at the time, and if I'm depressed that day or if I'm, like, super jazzed up that day, the material might be the same, but I'll present it however it's real. You know, I don't have a character where I'm like, you know,
right.
or whatever it is. I mean,
maybe you should certainly
not putting that down, but you're much more bound, you know, or I'm the angry guy. I'm angry about stuff. You know, I've got to work up an anger. It just is, like, just not my thing because my thing is just trying to be in the moment, as cocky or actory as that sounds. But it shouldn't be actory. It should be how everybody does it. I mean, I think, isn't it a therapy thing? Like, if you live in the past, it's depression. And if you're living in the future, that's anxiety. So it's like there's really only one place to kind of find peace.
Well, it's like the music I want to hear and the shows I want to see are when the performer is just right there in the moment. I don't want to see some pre-choreographed, like, planned out thing where at this point in the song, I, you know, I lift my head up and I look at the lights, and the lights come back. I don't want to see that. I want to see somebody who's...
Or if it is, I don't want to know it.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
how good it has to be.
And I wonder if you have some standard for yourself, like in this crazy Hollywood make-believe world of all this stuff. Is there, like, do you have a standard of what's real, and is it important to you to be authentic to yourself or to hold yourself accountable to a certain standard that you grew up with? Like, does it cross your mind?
It doesn't really cross my mind. I think, you know, it's funny because there are those moments where you go to put something on and you go, oh, is this too, like, hip? Like, I'm trying, like, you know, and then you go, well, then if I take this off because I think it looks too hip because I'm trying, then that's me being influenced by the outside world or some preconceived notion or some worry about how something might be perceived. And so
it's
that's silly.
It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, you know, I'm that's silly, you know. But it's a, I complain, but I'm probably lucky that I always say I'm the poorest to famous, I'm the poorest celebrity to fame ratio non-scandal, you know, like, because I don't, you know, I make videos on my couch. You know, I've had a couple, like, good cash gigs here and there, and I can make money on the road, but I don't go on the road so much I don't take advantage of every penny I can make. I probably should. Now that I think about, you know, death and the future and who's going to care for me and will I be able, you know, but I don't come from a family that's ever valued money beyond, you know, being able to live a comfortable life. You know, I own my car. I actually just got a new car, where it was from last year. I got a car, a one-year-old car recently, but I had my car for 12 years. It works. I own it. I own my apartment. And what else do you need beyond that? You know, I'm not a, this is the most jewelry I've ever worn. This is like my dog's old tag who died. And a guy that I slept with left this at my house last night.
There you go.
But I cannot get my head around jewelry or purses, you know, like it's a purse. It's a bag. It holds stuff. Get a backpack. You're being ridiculous. I don't want to seem preachy, and I have lots of girlfriends that, like, you know, have rings and have jewelry, and I love them. I love every part of them, you know. It's just not me, but I also cannot get my head around it. I'm also a vegetarian, and I can't imagine eating meat. All my friends are meat eaters. And maybe that's the best part of whatever happened to things not being your cup of tea. You know, I feel like we live in a world right now where if people are living their lives in a different way than you, you want to make policy around it, you know?
But, right, right.
You know, I live a very different life than most of my friends. And I like the way I live my life, and I love them however they live their lives. But I just am not a stuff person. Stuff stresses me. I don't want things.
No, but you know, I think that's exactly the point. I think that I was...
But I can afford to live exactly the life I want. You know,
sure.
When people go like, I have to do this shitty TV show I don't believe in because I've got to support my kids. I've got a family that, you know, in my family, a waitress and a truck driver that raised two amazing kids. You know, I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to take that TV show. I mean, I think you could probably make it by, you know, you can get anyway.
No, but
it's also great if you get a sitcom and you can feed your family and
sure.
Do all those things. And that's a choice you make. No judgment. I'm just saying I'm very free artistically and creatively because I keep my overhead very low.
I think that's exactly like
payments to make. I don't need a fancy car. I'm not into jewelry. I don't understand purses that cost any amount of money. You know, that it's bizarre to me.
You know, I read your autobiography just over the last 2 weeks, and you know, it was hilariously funny, but at the same time, it was like really scary to me because, you know, you went through some really tough things. You know, you wet the bed until, you know, you were a teenager, and you were depressed, and you were on meds, and, you know, as a father of three girls, I think about like, you know, what problems are my kids going to go through that they're not going to share with me, that they think it's taboo and they can't talk to anyone, and how are they going to internalize that? And I read your book thinking about how hard it must have been for your parents to see you go through that stuff. I mean, it was a different era, but I think you love your kid. You love your kid, and you don't want to see him go through that stuff.
Yeah, you're only as happy as your least happy kid, right? Who said that?
Yeah, yeah.
Not me, but I believe it's true.
Did you ever question them later why they would send you to sleepaway camp, knowing that you had this traumatic bedwetting problem?
Yeah, they both are like, I don't know, but I know it's because they both were horrible outcasts in school. They were both Jews in Catholic schools in the 50s, 60s. Yeah. And not popular and miserable. And both of them went to summer camp and were stars. And that was their joy. That was their only happiness of their life was summer camp. And they wanted that for me. And they couldn't see beyond their own experience, you know?
Did they send you more than once?
Yeah, every year since I was six.
And so would you come home and say, I can't do it? I'm like, it's
hard. I would beg not to go. I would have so much anxiety when it would be coming, you know. I would know that I had to leave. I mean, the summer was terrifying for me. It was humiliating. And, you know, some camps I did have a good time, and I, you know, the counselor would walk me in the middle of the night to pee, and I wouldn't pee, you know, and I was funny, and I played sports, but there was always a lot of anxiety around it, and, you know, making my cot over just soaking wet sheets, and that probably stank, you know, and just pretending it wasn't happening, you know?
Yeah, it's, I mean, you think of it from a parent's perspective, and you know, you can't help your kid either. Like, that's just the deal. Anatomically, that was going to happen until it stopped, and so I guess they wanted you to have a normal life.
Yeah. Like, and I think they've also grew up in families where parents have the summer off and the kids go,
right.
You know. And I don't think that was their instincts, but I think it's just all they knew at that young age, you know. And it's also was their joy in their life experience. You know, I'm not angry at them about it.
Sure.
It's perplexing, but I don't. I love them, you know.
No, but you know, in
you know, and I wrote that book and I said all these things and they were completely proud and supportive of it. They could have been much more ego driven and been like, how could you say that we, you know, I mean, like, you know, the people who read that book know that my parents sent me as a bedwetter to sleepover camp, and they took it like champs. They did. They're both wonderful.
And thinking especially about We Are Miracles, I wanted to ask you a few more questions about that. First off, you decided to do it in the small room at Largo, which is like 39 audience members.
Yeah, well, it holds 50 people. In my mind, it was like 50 people. But what I didn't realize is with the fire marshal codes, and I mean, it's literally 50 people, including me and the crew. So the audience was just 39 people.
Why did you decide to do it in such a small room?
I always wanted to do that. I had that idea a long time ago. I'd love to do, you know, you never see specials in a really small room. But then warming up for that, I did a bunch of gigs, you know, in big rooms because, you know, to make a living and to practice the order and the set and everything. And, you know, as laughs would like wash over me in a symphony hall, you know, in Nashville, I'm thinking, what have I done? I fucked up. There's probably a reason people don't do shows for 39 people. It's not a good idea.
But I thought it was
but
great.
But it was cool, I mean, yeah. And when I came back here, actually, I did shows at UCB, and they were very nice to let me do, like, 5 p.m. unannounced shows, and they'd only let 39 people in, so I could practice the timing of that, because a joke that would have a laugh that would give me time to, you know, posture, you know, whatever, you know, and look at my notes and take a sip of, you know, a victory sip of water.
Sure.
It goes back to zero much faster with a crowd of 39 people. So you have to kind of know the set more and keep it going a little bit faster because it goes back to zero faster with 39 people. So I was lucky to be able to practice that a few times.
And I imagine you get to know the faces throughout the time you're on stage, and it's not like this faceless thing where you can focus on what you're doing. Like, I'm sure someone in the front row can affect the show a lot more, right?
Completely.
Yeah.
If there's one person like this, any comic will tell you. Everyone can be having a good time. If there's one person like this, it's just all you can focus on.
Now, is that guy almost in a strange way get more respect because you're like, I have to make him laugh?
Yeah.
So,
but if you are smart enough and you know, you go, fuck him, this crowd's having a good time, but the set of fucked upness that it takes to be a comedian doesn't really tend to lend itself to being able to see the big picture, you know?
That's not what comedians can do all the time.
Yeah, it's like, they like me, but what's wrong with you? You know.
But it's not what's wrong with him, it's what's wrong with you. Like, that's
100%. I mean, you don't know what this guy's story is. I mean, half the time they sit like this and they go, well, that was good.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like,
that's how you figure, like, A.O. Scott sits in a movie, right? And you don't know if he enjoys it at the end or what. Like, that's just how they do it. I think I stand like that at shows.
Well, I mean, a lot of comics watch other comics and they go, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You know.
And in We Are Miracles, I noticed that, you know, there was this sort of connective tissue between your stories of sort of, you know, this idea that, you know, isn't it insane what we have allowed this country to become and what we accept and what we accept as normal. You know, and
right.
I thought there was so much more social commentary in it, and the observations were so, like, so sharp. And you said at one point, you said, you know, the people who say he threw me under the bus, right? Like, that speaks to a proclivity to throw blame on other people. Well, that's a pretty deft observation, right? It's pretty like that's, and what I started wondering was. We all have observations occasionally that we find our minds, you know, spiraling down that path.
And, yeah.
But how do you, like, what's your process for turning an observation like that into a story that works on stage or as a joke? I mean, is it something that rattles around in your mind for a long time until you're like, oh, I have a take on this?
Or? Yeah. And for me, Twitter has been a great medium for writing.
Oh, really?
Because I'll look back on stuff and I'll go, oh, that connects with this, and this connects with this, and this was not even a funny tweet. This was just like, you know, political comment or something. But I'll be able to kind of see it with the perspective. I really like it for that. Some comics think that you're burning jokes. I don't because it hasn't been honed or figured out or anything. It's just 140 characters, and some people maybe saw it, and some people, you know.
Right.
But, I mean, I guess that's kind of like trying out material on talk shows and then figuring it out later.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's not one way. I don't think about it, really. But, wait, what was the question?
Oh, so, well, I wondered how you...
Oh,
how you sort of how do you write a joke that's not a joke, but it's more of a story and it fits in with your overall theme of, you know.
Well, I noticed that. I started, and a lot of it is shitty reality TV. Some of the the smarter jokes I feel like I write is like from watching Real Housewives. I mean, like, to me, watching Real Housewives is completely where I thought your obsession with your looks and trying to look younger and is makes your daughter not dream about her future. It, you know, is the reason why your daughter doesn't look forward to adulthood at all, because it's just this terror-filled attempt to look younger with shots and cuts and weird, and you become this weird Frankenstein monster. I mean, it's just, it's really heartbreaking. And I would just, you notice the people that say, he threw me under the bus, I feel like they say it a lot. It's, they say, they use that a lot.
Right.
And it's just a lot, a mixture of that and therapy and learning myself to look inward and to the joy and relief of being responsible for your own happiness and all these lessons that I'm learning and I get excited about, and it's, and you practice because you slip out of it a lot and you go, oh, wait. And just attempting to live a conscious life makes you see it in other people. You know, it's easier to see things in other people than
sure.
in yourself.
But you find a way to turn that into this well-crafted, you know, I don't even want to say a joke. It's not, I mean, it's more of it's a story that, like, I found myself in We Are Miracles watching it and being entertained on different levels, and maybe not even entertain is the word, on one level, which was, you know, you kind of force people to sometimes think about things in uncomfortable things.
If, like, you can't live a life where you're satisfied with who you are and the
right.
case you're in and that, you know, and embracing all the parts about getting older and stuff. I mean, that's hard, especially in this town. But if you can't do that, your daughter is watching you.
Like, right. But I think you open that story with saying, you know, why do we tell girls they can grow up and be anything? And I don't know if that was connected to that joke, but it, you know, you start thinking about, you know, what do we tell our kids versus what do we show our kids? And
yes.
you know, here I am watching a comedy special, and I'm starting to get a little, like, nervous about, am I doing the right thing as a parent? Am I, you know, I start, and I realize, okay, she's doing what great artists do. They, like, she's hiding the medicine and the food without even trying. She just can't help herself. This is what she's thinking about. And because she's being so honest on stage, something's happening to me. And I wonder if that's something that you notice, like, or that you feel a greater responsibility to do now that you know how to do it. It's like you have more tools and you can...
Well, also just a lot, you know, I watched it, I went, oh, I'm so preachy, you know, and there's got to be better ways to do that. Or, you know, there are things I would have changed. I would have kind of more laughed through the preachy stuff to make it less so. But also what you have to realize is that 90% of the time I'm preaching to myself, you know. And Louis will, you know, I'll watch Louis sometimes and I'll go, you did that. And he's like, it was 100% me. I was
right.
the guy on the plane that was complaining that the internet was down.
Or, right,
you know, whatever.
Right.
And it's, we're talking, these are lessons that we're learning about ourselves and then painting a picture of it, you know.
So when something rings really true to you, you have the ability to turn that into something on stage that, like, that's what I see. Like,
yeah, yeah. And you know, for instance, that what you referenced, don't tell girls they can be anything they want when they grow up, because it wouldn't occur to them that they couldn't. You're planting that in their head.
Right.
And I got that because I was on the other side of that where... I was in the car with my brother-in-law, Yosef Israel Abramowitz, who happens to be Jewish. And they have 5 kids. And when the kids were young, I said, well, you're going to get free to be you and me, right? I mean, they have to have free to be you and me, right? You grew up with free to be you and me.
And we have it on vinyl in our house.
I said, you're going to get that for the girls, right? You're going to get, you know. And he goes, you know what? I don't want the girls to hear Free to Be You and Me. And I was so mad. And I was like, how can you say that? And he said, because it would never occur to my girls that they couldn't be anything they wanted to be when they grew up.
But also that was in the 70s. And
right.
Maybe that was reactionary to a lot of
totally.
Things,
for the time, it was huge. It affected, It was, you know, it affected, I'm assuming both of us.
Yes, very much so.
I know every word to every one of those songs and all the lessons that were in it and about, and the sexes. And in many ways, it is apropos now. Like, I'd like to play it, like, in the Senate. But, you know, my nieces and nephews are raised in such a way that it would never in a million years occur to them that they couldn't do something that they wanted to do, like,
right.
put their mind to. And,
right.
and, you know what I mean? I mean, they don't, they were almost in a maybe too sheltered a way. They were shocked about the gay issue because they're all raised that someday, if you're lucky, you meet a boy or you meet a man or a woman that you fall in love with. It was never
right, right.
My sister and my brother-in-law never said, like, you know, to my nieces, you'll meet a man who, or to my nephews, you'll meet a woman. They always just go, you'll meet a guy or a girl that you love, and you know what I mean. So they're just. And they live in Jerusalem, and they just live this hippie, you know, they were grown up in this world where there just isn't that kind of unacceptance or hatred or,
right,
you know.
Right. It's almost like we take
so the
things that
they're shocked by it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. We take the things that were big issues for us, and if you don't think about it, you pass them on to your kid, but maybe it wouldn't have occurred to them. That's right.
Yeah, and your issues are not always your kid's issues.
Right.
And I don't have kids, and I have no right to be preaching about this, but no, I was a kid.
And it also brings up, for me, a question that I was thinking of earlier when you were talking about the audience and about how, you know, you tried out material. It brought up a question for me of you, now that you, you know, you are Sarah Silverman and you are, you know, considered on this level of comedy, can you really bomb anymore? In other words, like, can you?
I have to.
Can you,
I mean,
judge the audience, or do they kind of give you a pass?
Oh, okay. Well, no, I might come out and be a surprise on a show and get a big applause, but I can still totally bomb trying new things. I mean, they might give you some leeway up front, but I mean, and you know, they're such inspiring comics like Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld, who, you know. I mean, Chris goes out and he bombs. He doesn't give a fuck, you know? And Chappelle, they know that they have to go out and do sets where they don't know what they're doing. They're flailing. They're trying things. They have a little piece of something. And you have to be willing to disappoint the audience in order to develop new material. Otherwise, you're doing the same jokes that you know work.
So you still have to do, no matter how far you get, you still have to go and do the same thing you did at the beginning of your career.
100%. And it's, in to a degree, it's harder because, you know, people can videotape it and put it and watch me bomb it. But all that has to be out the window. It's just like it just fucks you up. It impedes, like, any kind of growth. Or, you know, you can only do so much in front of your mirror at home, stand-up-wise. You have to do it in front of a crowd, you know? You have to.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Sometimes things bomb, and it just needs, like, an article. It just needs the tiniest word or the tiniest little switch to be fixed, or just something inside your head. You know, like, I had a joke years ago that I was going to drop. It never worked. And then this comic I worshipped, Mike Sweeney, said, like, oh, I really like that joke. And then it started working just because I knew that someone I admired liked it. It changed something in the chemistry of me, you know, that you can't put your finger on.
Right, right. Like, yeah, it's funny, like, how much does confidence play a role in just the basic delivery of a joke?
And yeah. And you can also love something and have it work and then over time forget what was funny about it to you, and it won't work anymore, you know?
Right, 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 right. Gosh, you use music a lot. In your act too, which, and I always draw parallels between music and comedy, and I think that
comics always want to be musicians, and musicians always want to be comics.
Right, it's amazing. But you know, here you are as somebody who, you know, you write a lot of songs that further your comedy, and you have a great voice. And I, you know, I just wonder, like, have you ever made or wanted to make a serious record, or have you ever like had the desire?
I wrote a serious song, and I wanted so bad to get like, you know, Miley Cyrus or Taylor Swift or like one of those, like, I guess they're not really teeny boppers anymore, but back when I wrote it, they were just like just starting out, or one of those like, you know, Disney princess like slash singer girls to sing, because it was like a perfect teen angst song. But it, you know, it was serious to me, but I don't think I could do that.
Because it's funny. It's almost like when you're funny.
I can to myself in my own world, but I...
But you couldn't put it out there. Because I think when you're a comedian, you know, people just always expect that. And so it would be impossible for you to sit down with a guitar and sing a song, because everyone would be waiting for the joke.
I did a show at Largo that was all music, and I went up with a band and sang, because we had learned it for our friend Rob Schraub's wedding, the Conor Oberst song, This Is the Best Day of My Life, you know. So they said, will you do it at Largo? I said, yeah. And I went on and I said, and I shouldn't have said anything, but I was like, this isn't a comedy thing. It's just, you know, whatever. It's like I protested too much, that as soon as I started singing, the audience started laughing. And it was like, this isn't funny. This is a beautiful song. You know, it's just, there was nothing I could say that didn't make the audience go, okay, yeah,
that's
up for sleeve. And nothing was up my sleeve. I was just singing a pretty song, but I just was like, I can't. There's no way to set it up. There's no way for them to believe me. And also, it's just, you know, but I love heartbreaking music. That's my favorite stuff. I love singer-songwriters with just, you know, Patty Griffin is one of my favorites, and all that stuff that just kills you.
Well, yeah.
I don't have to be it.
No, you know, but you said, you know, comedians want to play music.
It's true, yeah. You know, a comedian putting out like serious music is never.
It doesn't go both ways.
Never embraced.
Right. Someone can always try to be funny, but a funny person, it's very hard for them to go do something serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about the song from Jesus Is Magic, the You're Going to Die song.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I think of all the things you've done, that's the one that made me kind of wonder the most about, like, filming that on the day, because you're on like a nursing home set and you've got all these actors.
I had to slam a coffin door on an 89-year-old lady.
Yeah. Yeah, you have all these actors in their 70s and 80s and they're on their respirators, and you're just screaming you're going to die at them for, like, I'm sure a whole day of shooting. And was that awkward?
No, they're all into it, you know? I mean, you know, I don't know. Yeah, it was a little awkward. But yeah, because, you know, the song rang very true, I'm sure.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah, most of them are dead.
Yeah. You think now most of the people that appeared in that are dead?
At least some.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it made me wonder, like, that's where I wondered, okay, there must be just...
I think to them it was refreshing, and they're all actors. They were actors. So they, you know, I think all actors, you don't have to be a comedian to have a kind of sardonic, you know, sensibility.
Sure. It says more about how afraid I am to die that I would think that would just be too painful to sit in a room when you're that close to it.
It's scary. People always go, like, if I could live to 87, I'd be happy. And I go, yeah, you'd be happy until you were 86.
Exactly.
Nobody wants to die. But we're all going to, alone.
It's horrible. It's horrible.
Not even worth thinking about.
I want to devote the rest of our time to that subject.
Okay.
Okay. What do you consider some of your weaknesses or shortcomings?
I'm a perfectionist. I'm just kidding. I hate when people say that their shortcoming is they're a perfectionist.
And they do.
Models always say that. Oh, I'm a perfectionist. Such an arrogant thing to say is your shortcoming.
I'm too nice to people.
I'm too nice. I give too much. My shortcomings.
I guess I'm asking, you know, what do you
lazy.
Work on? You're lazy.
I'm really lazy. I anticipate with fear things. You know, I don't like leaving my apartment.
A little agoraphobia.
Yeah, yeah. I like to stay in my apartment. I'm very unadventurous. And I watch a lot of television. My joy is just, you know, taking a bath and then watching just crappy TV all night. And, you know, and there's so much out in the world. And I'm not worldly. I'm not, you know, I've never been to Japan or China or Sweden or I should just name the places I have been.
A shorter list.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny when someone who's so successful and so, you know, known for doing so many things says they're lazy because, you know, I hear that and I go, well, where do you find the time to do everything you do? You know what I mean? But it's a common thing, I think, that people who create stuff think of themselves as lazy.
Yeah, you know? I am, though. I mean, I know I am. And, I have a monthly show at Largo and it comes around and I go, I don't have any fucking thing to say. I don't have anything to say, you know. And Flanagan laughs at me. He's like, that's what you say every month. But it's true. And, you know, sometimes I get lucky on stage and something happens, you know, or I spend that day working and I get something out of it. I go, why don't I do this every day? I'd have so much material, you know.
Right. Like you set up that monthly show and it makes you work. Like, do you need a motivation like that? Do you have to have like a deadline or a
I do. I need a deadline. But that said, I mean, when I wrote my book, it wasn't done and I passed it in 8 months late.
But, oh, really?
But it wasn't done. I mean, what's a deadline really? It's a book. It could come out any time.
Right.
But it wasn't because I was being lazy. It really wasn't done.
Because I wasn't writing it. Because no, I was watching TV.
I was.
So it wasn't done.
But yeah, I'm really lazy and, you know, I like to do just one thing a day.
What does that mean?
Like friends who will go to dinner and then go see a movie and then go to a party. I mean, like, to me, I pick one. Like, I get overwhelmed. I need a lot of sleep.
Are you a loner?
I'm a loner. You know, even when I'm seeing people, I need to be alone. That's something I learned. I had a very long relationship, and I learned from that that I need to be alone, and that there are people who need to not be alone, and that can really, like, make you forget that you need to be alone.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
Like, I was like, getting sick was like the only way I could be alone in this relationship. But it's like, yeah, my mom always told me to be my own best friend, and I think I took it to an extreme because I really need it. I need to be alone a lot. But I love people. You know, one thing I noticed is people who like to be alone, I love to be alone, but I love people. And there are some people that can't be alone, and they hate people.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes total – I mean, someone listening to that may think, like, that makes no sense at all. But that makes sense to me because I know that if I don't have time to myself, I don't do well. And I'm like you, exactly. I need – and it's hard for me to ask for it, too, especially in a relationship. It's hard to say when, you know – Because often the time you need to be alone most is when you can't communicate. You need to be alone.
Yeah.
But that I think that does make me, when I join the world of people again, a much better person for it.
Yeah.
You know? Well, listen, I got to tell you, it's so nice to get to know you because I've seen you so many times. And there's a softness or a sweetness to you at your core that I don't think you could do what you do and ride that line as well as you do if you had lost that or if that had gone away. But you seem to me very close to the girl that you're describing in the autobiography. Like, it doesn't seem like you've gotten away from who you are, your core, and it's lovely to be around people like that who know who they are but also haven't forgotten who they are. You know what I mean?
You're welcome.
So it's been really nice getting to know you. And I appreciate all the time and everything. And I hope this will, you know, inspire more people who don't know me to come do the show.
Come do the Sam Jones show. That's not what it's called, but...
It's called Off Camera.
Off Camera.
We usually prep the guests before we bring them on.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.